Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're talking to a physician and amateur athlete, Dr. DeWade Perry. He's the go-to guy when it comes to sports nutrition and exercise advice. And in part one, DeWade, we were talking about the notion of carbo loading, which you say is obsolete. There's a trend now among some athletes to embrace a very low carb or ketogenic diet. It's claimed that if you do that, you become a virtual fat burning machine. You just are sucking down your body fat, burning it off, and you have plenty of energy with just lots of dietary fat, minimal carbs.
Right. Well, that so ketogenic dieting and exercise was a very exciting topic maybe a couple years ago, but now it's starting to be exposed as not the best thing for athletes.
Right.
And the literature that initially came out showing lots of benefit was from Dr. Folic, Del Folic, and his studies were pretty impressive. But lately what we're finding is those individuals, those athletes who do ketogenic dieting, they tend to lose top-end speed, number one. They tend to lose the ability to sprint toward the end of races, and their performance suffers. So, because of the lack of carbohydrates.
Yeah, they need some.
They need some because utilizing fat for fuel burns up more oxygen than does utilizing carbohydrates. So it slows the athlete down, bottom line. Mm-hmm. So it has not turned out to be a better approach for athletes. And I think the tide is going to start turning back towards at least a moderate intake of carbs.
Mm-hmm.
And not just strictly a ketogenic approach.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And then there are the athletes who eschew gluten products, like Djokovic, the tennis player, felt that his tennis performance improved dramatically. There have been some other
right.
professional athletes who've done that, baseball players and some football players. And then, of course, there's Tom Brady, who is on a very, very exacting diet program. It's not necessarily an ultra-low-carb diet, but it's more of a very select Mediterranean diet.
Yes. And I don't know, I haven't seen any studies showing gluten, the intake of gluten is adverse for or adverse to athletes. However, if a person notices an obvious reaction to gluten, then I think it's totally prudent to eliminate it from your diet and going about your way. I really don't think there are any deleterious effects from eliminating gluten. And microscopically, if you talk to some experts in the field, some individuals who consume gluten can experience things like leaky gut.
Mm-hmm.
And if one has leaky gut, there could be systemic inflammation, and that can impact athletic performance. So I don't really have an issue at all with individuals eliminating gluten if they believe it's going to enhance their athletic performance. So I say kudos to those athletes who do that. In fact, I don't consume any gluten myself, not because I think it enhances my performance. I just don't do it because I don't eat foods that contain gluten. So
for other health reasons.
Kudos.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so big dilemma. You know, a lot of people kind of feel that they're like cars. And before they go to the gym, they'll have, they'll have a protein bar or they'll have, some juice. They need something to fuel their exercise. And yet studies suggest that maybe they're misguided in that approach. Should you eat before the workout? Should you eat after the workout? And what should you be having? And what's the time interval that's optimal for supporting muscle repair and reducing delayed onset muscle soreness.
Right. Yeah. So there are a few things about this topic that are important. The first is if we talk about the post training period, I'll go to the pre training period in a second. But if one talks about the post training period, there used to be what was called the golden hour. Okay, and that was where, especially in the gym, where folks would, as soon as they finished training, they would rush over, grab their protein bottle, shake it up, you know, the protein powder, shake it up, and guzzle it down within, you know, 30 seconds of finishing their last repetition.
So as if the amino acids would spring into their muscles immediately and, like, you know, fill up their myocytes and make them expand.
Exactly. Yeah, that was the thought. But that's another myth that has been exploded, and there is no golden hour, okay? One can consume a protein-rich meal, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours after training and still get the same benefit. So one does not need to, you know, immediately look for something to eat within an hour. I just wanted to get that fact out there.
Okay.
Now, when we talk about pre-training, usually within a couple hours is fine, and just a mixed meal, some protein, some fat is fine, and carbohydrates. Just a simple mixed meal. This whole notion of sort of pre-workout has become popular, pre-workout drinks and supplements that have become popular in the last few years. I suggest patients and friends, the best pre-workout is between your ears. That is the best pre-workout supplement, if you will, that's available to you is your brain. Get yourself mentally ready to train, and you don't need any other supplement or any other supplement to do what you need to do in the gym. So I really believe it's a waste of money. Now, there are ergogenic aids that can enhance athletic performance, but pre training, you don't need anything special except food.
Yeah, I want to get into exercise supplements in a minute, but there recently was a study that suggested that if for weight loss purposes, say you're overweight and you're trying to exercise to optimize your weight, that it actually is counterproductive to take in some carbohydrates before your morning workout, because what then happens is that your body relies on those ingested carbohydrates rather than reaching into your fat stores to burn down your fat. Do you feel there's any substantiation for that belief?
So there's something called fasted cardio, especially fasted cardio, where individuals would do cardio in the morning in a fasted state. That whole concept became popular in the early 1990s when Bill Phillips introduced EAS, the supplement company EAS, and Body for Life. And one of his tenets was fasted cardio, with the belief that if one trains fast in the morning, all of the available carbohydrates will have been used up overnight during sleep, and so the only substrate or the predominant substrate that will be used during that cardio session in the morning will be fat. Well, over the ensuing decades, studies have shown that they're equivocal. Essentially, the studies tend to show there is increased fat oxidation when people train cardio exercise in a fasted state, but it doesn't seem to make much difference in terms of body composition. So that there's that issue. I personally train fasted just because
I do too.
I like the way I feel that way.
Yeah.
So So I don't think there's anything wrong with it, and I think it can be beneficial. But on the other hand, I don't think consuming some carbs in the morning will prevent appreciable fat loss. So I think it's person dependent and personal preference, certainly.
Okay.
Because there are studies that go both ways. So absolutely.
Okay, so when you have an opportunity to go to the gym, and say you're going to do a mixed workout, you know, which is you're going to spend a little time on the treadmill, maybe on the stationary bike, you know, then you're going to go up to the weight room, you know, lift some weights. You know, you got an hour and a half to kill in the gym. Is there an order to that? Should you be doing your strength training prior to your aerobic, or should you warm up on the aerobic training in order to be, loosened up or revved up for your strength training?
Yeah. Well, I think the literature is pretty clear on this. And the correct order is resistance training first and then cardiovascular training after that.
Okay.
And the reason is the studies show that when one does aerobic training before resistance training, he or she will lose strength during the resistance training component, and they will have less reps and less benefit. So what I typically recommend is a simple 5-minute warm-up just before strength training on any type of equipment one likes, you know, rower, elliptical, whatever. And then do your cardio session, or excuse me, do your resistance training session, and then follow that with your cardio. Now, optimally, you would do your cardio on a separate day from your resistance training. So that would be the optimal.
Yeah, that's approach. Even better, right.
That's even better. Second best would be cardio training a few hours apart from your resistance training, maybe 4, 5, 6 hours separating the resistance training from the cardio. And then thirdly would be your cardio session immediately after resistance training. So those are three scenarios if you're going to combine cardio with weight training.
Okay, and you see these athletes going through these elaborate stretching routines, you know, runners, you know, going to, you know, they do the splits and they go into contortions and they bend over and touch their toes. But there's actually, I've seen some studies that are controversial that suggest that this, the practice of pre-exercise stretching may or may not be with dividends. What's been your take on that?
Absolutely. There's literature that's pretty clear about that, too. So generally, stretching comes in two forms, static and dynamic. Basically, static stretching is where one stands in place or sits in place and holds a stretch for X amount of time, whereas dynamic stretching is where the limb being stretched is in motion during the entire period of stretching, if you will. So for 30 seconds, one can swing the leg back and forth, and that's called dynamic stretching. The literature shows that static stretching, especially before resistance training, decreases strength, decreases power output, decreases vertical jump height, and several other measures.
Wow.
So the best, the best thing to do before, especially resistance training, is dynamic stretching. So again, just swing your arms or swing your legs, and then go into your resistance training and warm up with the exercise you're going to do at that point. The other option is to use foam rolling. That foam rolling will increase flexibility without limiting performance in resistance training. So those are two options before resistance training. If you really like to do static stretching, save it for after a weight training session.
And it clearly has value, and you know that's one of the reasons why I've begun to incorporate yoga into my exercise regime, or I actually would call it more of a movement regime, because I think exercise has the notion of, you know, it's painful, you know, you have to break a sweat, but movement I think is something that can be a lifelong avocation, you know, even for people with physical limitations or the elderly. But yoga is something that is beneficial. I think it can be an adjunct to what I do, is I try to do triathlons. And, you know, one of the things that hobbles us, shall we say, mature triathletes is injuries. And I think that had we begun to do yoga and extended our flexibility earlier in life, that, you know, would have headed off some types of pain syndromes.
Right. Yoga is great. I think one of the misconceptions, however, with yoga, I'm talking conventional yoga that most people practice, is that it is a sufficient form of exercise in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And a great study was released within 2017 or late 2016 that evaluated the actual metabolic equivalent measurement of yoga. And it showed that traditional yoga, the most commonly practiced type of yoga in the United States, is not an adequate form of exercise in order to increase cardiorespiratory fitness. So I just like to make that point, because many people will say, when asked, you know, do you exercise?
I do yoga.
Oh, yes, I do yoga several times a week.
Yeah.
Right. So I just want to make that clear, that one needs to use other types of exercise to get the full cardio benefit of exercise, except for rather than just yoga. So that's important.
Okay, so wait, I want to get into supplements, but before we do that, permit us to allow a brief announcement from one of our sponsors, and then we'll tackle the issue of ergogenic supplements, performance-enhancing products. This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally, and it's so effective it works for 9 in 10 people. The Zona Plus is a high-tech smart device that guides you through a patented therapy that's personalized to your unique physiology. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 888-408-6141. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, you can get $50 off and free shipping. Just use the coupon code Hoffman at checkout at tryzona.com. Okay, folks, thanks for listening to that. So let's tackle the issue of supplements. Is there any magic elixir out there to improve performance? Is beet juice helpful for improving circulation, creating more pump when you're strength training, or more endurance when you're running? Do you use creatine right. to make your muscles bulge, or help you gain a few pounds on a weight stack?
Right. So there are definitely ergogenic aids that have been proven to work. However, the majority of what many people use is useless. So the list is short. Okay, beetroot juice definitely helps. It increases nitric oxide, and it is a proven ergogenic aid. Others include beta-alanine, mm-hmm. creatine for sure.
Excuse me, I just tried beta-alanine. And the reason I tried beta-alanine was to relieve what's called DOMS, delayed onset muscle soreness, which limits the amount of times you can work out, because you're trying to – I'm training for triathlon. I think you are as well. You don't want downtime. You want those days where you just feel too sore after working out. You want to be able to get out there. I tried it, and I don't know. I think maybe it helped a little bit, but it wasn't dramatically effective. And then I ran out of the beta-alanine, and I didn't notice much of a difference. Is that what it's for, or should it?
Oh, interesting. Well, it's primarily to extend an activity. So especially for sprinting, because as you know, what it does is it buffers the hydrogen atoms. It increases the pH. So lower pH is what causes muscle fatigue.
So it's about lactic acid threshold. Lactic acid threshold, sort of, at high ends
right.
of performance.
Exactly.
Maybe I never exactly. achieve such right. high levels of performance to experience the benefits of beta-alanine. I don't know. I'm just not awesome enough to get there. It's kind of like if you have a Ferrari that goes 200 miles per hour, but you only drive it in the city, you're not going to enjoy the benefits.
Exactly. That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. But it is a proven ergogenic aid, so it has a lot of benefit for some people. So that's one. I mentioned creatine and branched chain amino acids. And then caffeine is another ergogenic that's well documented. So those are probably the list that one should stick to if trying to increase or improve athletic performance. All the others, or the vast majority of the others, either have equivocal findings or really don't work.
How about stuff to protect the joints from injury? Do you use personally anti-inflammatory nutrients, fish oil, curcumin, glucosamine, chondroitin, some of those things? Because your joints really take a beating when you do all the things that you do.
Right. Well, I consume fish oil daily. I use it more for health purposes, but there are definitely athletic purposes too in the literature. However, I don't consume one pill a day. I consume 6 grams of EPA and DHA combined, which is 2 tablespoons of liquid. Mm-hmm, yes. Mm-hmm. So I consume a lot of fish oil. I also I go back and forth between glucosamine, using it and not using it, glucosamine sulfate. Mm-hmm. But primarily my anti-inflammatory supplement is going to be fish oil and vitamin D.
Mm-hmm. And of course, vitamin D. And actually, there are some, at least right. anecdotal studies or reports. I think it was the Chicago Blackhawks who won the Stanley Cup 1 year, and they were reputed to have taken vitamin D. And that was the big, that long northern winter, and it seemed to increase their stamina, which actually among the most demanding of professional sports, hockey is continuous motion. And, you may think these guys are just a bunch of barroom brawlers, but actually they're among the most superbly conditioned of professional athletes, even more so than NBA basketball players.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I remember that year, the whole team started taking vitamin D, and indeed they did win the Stanley Cup that year. So that was a very interesting, and that sort of put the spotlight on vitamin D for mm-hmm. that particular season, with good reason, of course. So,
and there are some studies that suggested vitamin D helps muscle strength. Although it's not going to make a couch potato into an awesome athlete. Okay, let's close with emphasizing rest, because there is such a thing as an overtraining syndrome. And so, how do you recognize that you're overdoing it? And what do you recommend in terms of rest? Do you work out 7 days a week?
So in this situation, I do train 7 days a week, but not all of the training is intense. Okay, so one has to modify training to get rest or active rest if you're going to train every day, which actually I don't recommend. So usually I'll take a day off 1 day a week. However, with training for the triathlon, in addition to my strength training and other activities, I'm training 7 days a week now. But if you're talking about overtraining, there are certain clues that you're training too much. One of the biggest ones is poor recovery. So when you try to train your next session, either you can't lift the same amount of weight,
you feel really
the same
flat.
Amount of reps, your running time is slower, what have you. Increased incidence of illness, that's another clue.
Mm-hmm.
Poor sleep is another clue. So there are some indications that you're overdoing it. Mood changes. That can also be an indication if you're more grumpy and just not as happy. That can be another indication that you're overtraining. So it is very important to get enough rest, and that not only means sleep at night, but it means recovery between exercise sessions. So it's a very important concept. And like I said, I generally recommend at least 1 day off from intense exercise per week. But that 1 day can be sort of active rest. It can be a slow hike, mm-hmm. or a non-strenuous hike, a simple bike ride, a short distance bike ride, something like that. So one doesn't have to be totally sedentary on that day mm-hmm. off, but just not engaging in strenuous exercise. Mm-hmm. Very important.
Yeah. And finally, is this an all or nothing thing? People listen to us having a dialogue. We're both committed athletes, and we're both training for triathlon. And there was a recent study that was encouraging for what are called weekend warriors, which that phenomenon we generally tend to poo-poo. People who are kind of sitting around, and then on the weekend they get out there and knock themselves out. And that's used to be looked down upon, but actually it turns out there may be some benefits still to that.
There are benefits to that. So medical societies recommend one of the two following: either 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity exercise or 75 minutes a week of high intensity exercise. We used to think that one needed to exercise most days of the week. In fact, that was a quote from the recommending agencies, most days of the week. But current studies have shown us that one can do almost all of that exercise in one session and still gain the benefit of exercise.
Right.
So, i.e. the weekend warrior. The caveat is to make sure you are in good enough shape to do that, because it takes a certain amount of health to be able to do 75 minutes or 150 minutes of exercise in mm-hmm. one session.
Mm-hmm.
So provided that a person is in a good enough shape to do that, one can do 75 minutes, 150 minutes of exercise in one session and still gain the benefit of exercising multiple days a week. That was a very exciting and interesting finding in this study.
Okay, wait, that's certainly encouraging. And it doesn't have to, it's very individualized. I think every person has their own personal goal, their own personal Mount Everest, whether it's, walking, in a 5K race, which is about two to three miles, that might be your personal goal. And that would be, that'll take you, way down the line towards greater health, and freedom from illness and greater longevity, even if you're not a champion. So I want to leave our listeners with that message. Great. So, Dwayne, where can listeners learn more? You have a website. Let's get the word out.
Yes. Yeah, my website is centerforihap.com, Center for Integrative Health and Performance.com. And on my website is information about me and ways to contact me and make an appointment if wanted.
Well, great. This is most illuminating, and I wish you all the best in your athletic endeavors. And is this your first triathlon?
Same to you.
Is this your first triathlon?
This will be my second triathlon.
Oh, great.
This will be my second. I did one in September, yes.
Olympic distance?
Oh, no. I do sprint distances.
Okay.
I do sprint distances, but yes. So this will be my second one.
Okay. Well, if I could bench press, 500 pounds, I probably would best be doing sprint distances. So. It's hard to do everything, because when you're so focused on the strength training aspect, you're really playing against type when and kudos to you for getting out there and experiencing the challenge of something that's quite different from your usual routine. So all the best to you.
Thank you.
In your athletic career and your professional career. Thanks for joining us. Very useful information, and we'll get you back on for an update soon. That's Dr. Dwayne.
Glad to be here. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Dwayne. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.
Thanks a lot.
This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.